The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We got the fly out of the studio, and we are ready to roll. I think Sam nearly killed himself trying to get rid of this noisy fly. How he got down into the cellar here, who knows? But we're quiet as a mouse down in this tiny little box that we're in, and ready to sound the alarm, as you often hear from this program, from the Key of David, and of course, you read about it at thetrumpet.com and in our literature. There's so much to discuss in these last days that we're living in. Thanks to Andrew Locher, by the way, for filling in on yesterday's show, The Birth of a Nation. A real solid theme this week of history and learning from that precious history. I talked some on Tuesday's program ahead of the July 4th holiday in the United States about the Declaration of Independence, and then Joel Hilliker touched on that same subject yesterday at the Trumpet Hour. If you didn't hear that yet, you can get to his podcast at thetrumpet.com website. He talked about the inspiration behind the Declaration of Independence, and also there's a segment in there about the Civil War history and just drawing on some of the lessons from the Civil War and what we're facing today with all of the division, particularly in the United States. So lots to learn in perusing the Trumpet.com website. And as you'll see, even with the content that we'll look at here on today's show, I mean, this is something we really have to keep reinforcing, these lessons of history. Victor Davis Hanson had a piece about how history has nothing much at all. History has nothing much at all. All of these ridiculous comparisons. Border patrol agents, they're at the southern border of the United States. They're compared to Nazis. Compared to Nazis, the radical left, of course, the president is Adolf Hitler, and the border patrol agents are Nazis. And Hansen says, if everything is like the Nazis, then the Nazis of history are no different from an ICE officer, a White House staffer, or maybe you and me. And he gives all of these recent examples that you've heard from the radical left making these ridiculous comparisons. This one in particular from a few weeks ago by Donnie Deutsch at MSNBC. Here's clip one.
We can no longer say Trump's the bad guy. If you vote for Trump, you're the bad guy. Mm-hmm. If you vote for Trump, you are ripping children from parents' arms. The mistake that we've made in the past is look at that bad guy over there. Look at that bad guy. What the Democrats have to do is make the next election a referendum not who Trump is, but who you are. If you vote for Trump, then you, the voter, you, not Donald Trump, are standing at the border like Nazis, going, you here, you here.
If you're one of the 60 million who voted for Donald Trump, I mean, you're a Nazi. You're a Nazi. The former CIA director, Michael Hayden, I've mentioned before, the picture he tweeted out of the Nazi extermination camp at Auschwitz, and then said, hey, we're doing the same thing today by separating mothers from children. Hansen says the suggestion was that industrialized death on an unprecedented scale was somehow similar to the temporary detention of children once their parents had been detained for violating federal law. That's what they're comparing this to. The industrialized death of on an unprecedented scale. Well, he gave quite a few other examples besides Donnie Deutsch. The actor Peter Fonda, Bill Kristol even, Laura Bush. So not just the radical left, but even the Republicans who hate the president and his administration. Hansen says, if George W. Bush, and of course these comparisons were made not just with Trump, but as he says, if you, you know, Laura Bush should remember what they were saying about her husband 10, 15 years ago. If George W. Bush is Hitler or Stephen Miller is Joseph Goebbels or a German accented Trump is sending Mexican nationals to Auschwitz like death camps, then what is the patriotic thing for an American to do about them? One answer might be to take out Trump Hitler or to take up arms to stop his Nazi takeover of the U.S. or force the target of such slurs to submit to re-education to cleanse and reset his mind in a properly correct fashion. And Hansen says perhaps such logic is one reason we simultaneously see both the rise of Nazi slurs and the hyperbolic talk of killing a conservative president. And then he gives all the examples of that in recent months. Beheading the president, killing the president in a stage production. I played a montage for you along those lines, I think, last week. But coming back to this history, or as Hansen says in the title of his piece, history as nothing much at all. I mean, it really does reveal, it's not just hyperbole of the worst kind. I mean, it reveals just how ignorant people are of the truth about history. If Nazism was once the equivalent of authorizing military action against the genocidal Saddam Hussein, on the consent of 23 separate congressional writs, or the same as temporarily separating foreign nationals who entered the U.S. illegally from the children they brought into the country, then what exactly are the 60 million dead of World War II, which Hitler started, or the 6 million who were gassed, starved, or shot in the Nazi extermination archipelago, or the 27 million Russian dead on the Eastern Front? Answer, he says, their fates are all more or less analogous to those of the well-fed, clothed children temporarily separated from the parents who undertook a dangerous trip to bring them to the U.S. in violation of U.S. law. It's just the same in the minds of so many, this sick comparison. It goes both ways, as Hansen brings out. I mean, it elevates the political opponents into homicidal criminals, he says, who deserve to be punished, who deserve to be persecuted. And at the same time, it reduces these very real historical monsters into little more than petty partisan zealots. And he talks about just the ignorance and the arrogance coming out of the university today. Ignorance and arrogance. He picked up on this theme in an interview recently. I played, I think, a few excerpts from this. It's at The Federalist from a week or two ago. And I'm not sure if I played this particular bit or not. But here he is, Victor Davis Hanson, talking about the problem with education today. Here's clip two.
We start with this premise that men are sexist, or capitalism destroys the environment, or America's racist, and you find the examples to fit that preconceived idea. And the result of it is that we've turned out students that are highly partisan and highly mobilized and even sort of arrogant, but they're also ignorant because that came at a cost. They did not learn to write well. If you ask them, who's General Sherman, or what's a Corinthian column, or who was Dante, all of the building blocks that they could refer to later in life as to enrich their experience, they have no reference, and then they don't know how to think inductively. So if you point out the contradictions in free speech, the way they shout down some speakers and not others, or the way that they hate capitalism, but they love Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. They're not able, they haven't been trained philosophically to account for that because they're indoctrinated. And it's quite sad to see the combination of ignorance and arrogance in young people. But that's what we've turned out. A lot of people who are indebted and they're arrogant and they're ignorant and they're not up to the task of moving the United States forward as a leading country in the world.
It's quite sad to see this combination of ignorance and arrogance, and as he says, they're right at the last. Here is the oncoming generation, and they are not up to the task of moving the United States forward. They're indoctrinated. All of these contradictions, all of this ignorance, and then arrogance to go with it. What a dangerous combination. But coming back to the lesson of history, Hansen says at the end of his piece, history is now following a sort of Gresham's Law. Lots of cheap, bad history drives out what is left of good history. You really can't distinguish between the two. So much propaganda, so much indoctrination. The other day, I think it was Tuesday's show, we referred to that Oxford Union debate. Should we be ashamed of Churchill? That's what some of the students at Oxford are wondering. Many believe that, in fact. Should we be ashamed of Winston Churchill? The one man responsible for saving our Western society? We've been doing a fair bit of study into Churchill and his leadership during the wilderness years and during the Second World War. And yesterday, as it happens, we rewarded ourselves with the viewing of The Darkest Hour, this movie that came out last year. And as I covered with you on this program, we knew going in that there were some pretty big flaws in this movie. But it was supposed to be a lot better, a lot closer to the truth than the other one that came out, I think, at the start of last year, the one that was just called Churchill. But here are these two big Hollywood productions. And in the first movie, Churchill, we learn that Winston Churchill was supposedly dead set against the Normandy invasion and the liberation of Europe. He didn't want it to happen. And of course, that's not true. And then in The Darkest Hour, the one we saw just yesterday, well, they made Churchill out to look like he was weak and indecisive and just kind of flopping back and forth. They made it seem like Winston Churchill gave some serious thought to surrender, to negotiating with Hitler through an Italian mediator. As I say, The Darkest Hour was supposed to be the better movie, and it started off with some promise, but about halfway through, it really started to play around with the facts. And that was made, I think, all the more clear because some of us have been reading Manchester's books, his three-part series on the life of Churchill, and some other things together with it. As you know, we've written a lot over the years about Winston Churchill, about his leadership, about his courage, about how decisive he was. When he came into office, he became Prime Minister of Britain on May 10th, 1940. And if you look at what he was thrust right into the midst of, Austria and Czechoslovakia, Poland, they had all been crushed by the Nazi regime. And, the day that Churchill became prime minister, Hitler's forces were sweeping across the Low Countries. Belgium and the Netherlands. It was some would say a hopeless situation. The French troops, just in the first few days of Churchill, his prime ministership, the French troops were collapsing. They weren't holding the line. And so all of these German panzer divisions were just storming into the middle of France. And the British expeditionary forces, as you know from another movie that came out last year, another one that wasn't so good as far as just telling the story, the facts of the story. They made it more like a soap opera drama. The Miracle at Dunkirk. Some nice cinematography. But look at how loose they are with the facts. I know they're just movies, but still. You watch some of the good points of the movie we saw yesterday, and you see what an opportunity. What an opportunity with that kind of acting, with that kind of budget, with that kind of cinematography. What an opportunity you could have in teaching about history if you stick to the facts. You just don't see that. You certainly don't see it coming out of Hollywood. There's always an agenda. But here, I mean, Churchill's coming into his position as prime minister, and Britain was entirely alone. And there, as France was collapsing, I mean, and the United States, of course, was isolationist at the time. I mean, there was no prospect, no immediate prospect of Churchill receiving any support. He was prepared to go it alone, and he rallied all of the British people. I mean, the one thing about The Darkest Hour that makes it worth watching are these magnificent scenes in the House of Commons. I forget, I saw a clip this morning about how they set up the studio, so to speak. They couldn't film it in the actual House of Commons, and so I think they used one of the older buildings in the British Parliament and then basically refurbished it so that it looked like it looked back in 1940. And Gary Oldman, the actor, he did a fine job with some of the mannerisms and the accent and all those things. And from what I could tell, I mean, the actual speeches that were filmed in this setting, it did stick to the script. And so that part was really good. That part was actually stirring and inspiring. This is the clip from the movie where Gary Oldman. Now, you can find these clips, the actual clips from Churchill, but in many cases, Churchill, they didn't record them live back in 1938 and 39 and 1940. And so after everyone really understood the significance of his leadership when the war was over, Churchill came along and reread some of those speeches 8-9 years later. And it's nice that we have them in his own voice. But you do lose the tremendous sense of drama and just the power that must have been there when those speeches were given live in front of the House or in front of the cabinet, the government. And so, as I say, if there's one great takeaway from this movie, it's these scenes that have been recreated, these stirring and magnificent scenes. This one here, he comes into office on May the 10th and then gives his first address before the House of Commons 3 days later on May 13th. And this is how that scene was portrayed in the movie, clip 3.
We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I say it is to wage war by sea, land, and air with all our might and with all the strength that God can give us. To wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word. Victory. Victory at all costs. Victory. In spite of all terror, victory, however long and hard the road may be. For without victory, there can be no survival.
That's the speech that's in the movie. And in a lot of ways, just listening to it there again, I mean, it directly contradicts the plot of the 2-hour-long movie. What's our policy? It's to wage war. It's to fight against this monstrous tyranny And this comes straight from Churchill's speech. I mean, this is word for word. This was the actual speech that he gave. And to their credit, the director and the screenplay and all these, I mean, it was portrayed as it was given on May 13th, 1940. But then for much of the rest of the movie, you see how Churchill's resolve to fight against Hitler, how it was wavering, how he was tossed to and fro when that wasn't happening at all. Now, it is true that there were a lot of British elites at the time that thought that the government should consider some kind of conditional surrender. I mean, the memory of World War I, as Manchester writes in his biography, it did have a profound impact on the thinking in the island of Britain heading into the Second World War. People didn't want to see it happen again. Millions of boys were slaughtered in the trenches. And so there were some among the British elites who thought, well, if we're going to lose, is it worth it to send all of our boys into a losing battle, a lost cause? Maybe we should negotiate a truce with Adolf Hitler and at least save the lives of tens of thousands. So Churchill did have that to some extent that he was going up against. He put together a coalition among rivals, including Neville Chamberlain, the former prime minister, and also the foreign secretary, Lord Halifax, who wanted to be prime minister himself. But there was more support for Churchill in the House of Commons, and there was more support in Britain as people's opinions were changing and changing dramatically as they saw what the Nazis were doing in Poland and then in Belgium, the Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, Luxembourg. And so Churchill comes along and he listens to some of this. Hey, Italy's offering to mediate. All you might have to do here is just acknowledge that Hitler can have Europe and then negotiate some kind of settlement here. Well, that's not something that Churchill considered. Listening to something like that in a contentious cabinet meeting is one thing. But then an entire two-hour movie, or at least the last hour of it, showing him, the man who saved Western society, showing him receiving inspiration from his wife, from the king, from people on the underground, the tube of all places. And then finally, he has the strength and the courage to stand up to Hitler. That's the way the story is told in The Darkest Hour. But you just heard the clip there. What did he actually say in his speech 3 days into his prime ministership? He wrote later about it in the Second World War, his history of that time period. Listen to this and see if you detect any wavering. He said, at last, this is what he was thinking when he became prime minister. He said, at last I had the authority to give directions over the whole scene. I felt as if I were walking with destiny, and all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial. He said, 10 years in the political wilderness had freed me from ordinary party antagonisms. My warnings over the last 6 years had been so numerous, so detailed, and were now so terribly vindicated that no one could gainsay me. He said later on, I was sure I should not fail. Does that sound like he was wavering at the end? Or wavering there at the outset of the battle for Britain? In the movie, there's also all of these plot lines about a conspiracy against Churchill to try to unseat him. And here again, the facts, I mean the truth, is that while there may have been some leftover appeasers in his cabinet, while there may have been some frustrated cabinet members, there was no plot to bring Churchill down. He had, fine, like he said there in his memoir, finally he had the support. I mean, for 6 years, his warnings, so detailed, so numerous, and now they had been so terribly vindicated. No one could gainsay me. It's like I said the other day. I mean, that track record. And Clementine, she pointed it out too. Your track record is what saved you. Even from the mistakes. Like in Norway in the early part of 1940. Churchill, the truth is, Churchill stood against these calls for capitulation, for surrender. And at the same time, I mean, he's trying to strengthen the coalition. He wasn't exactly well-liked before coming into office, but all of Britain knew that he was the man for the job. Boris Johnson, who wrote the book about Churchill, the Churchill Factor, it's called, in his book, he talked about the many war cabinet meetings that were going on in those crucial days in May 1940. Between May 26th of that year and May 28th, there were 9 meetings. Churchill's war cabinet had 9 meetings. And as I say, there certainly was some disagreement, some contentious discussions. But Churchill's resolve, his willingness to fight, his determination to stand up to Hitler, it remained firm throughout. The National Review earlier this year, writing about, again, the way the movie portrayed it, it says here, this is how the movie tells the story. Hectored by a combination of Chamberlain and his fellow appeaser, Halifax, the Prime Minister is shown as nearly ready to give in and sue for peace through Mussolini. Buckling under pressure, he rediscovers his resolve only because of last-minute pep talks from his wife Clementine and King George VI. The clincher is that traffic halts the premier's car and he's forced to take the underground to Parliament. And of course, in this scene, you know, you have all these British commoners who are there saying, look, we want to fight him. Stand up to him. You get our support. National Review says, write and screenwriter Anthony McCartan would have us believe that the ghostwriters of the immortal speech to follow were random Londoners Churchill met on that train, where they gave him both courage and some of the actual words he later used. Yeah, he got in front of his cabinet later that day and started with his speech and quoted some of the people in the underground tube. And of course, that never happened. Neither did the meeting with the king, King George VI. What happened in the midst of that flurry of meetings between May 26 and May 28, after a contentious war cabinet meeting, he adjourns the meeting and then says, we'll come back later tonight. And at that evening meeting, this is May 28th, 1940, Churchill invited his entire cabinet, all of his government, not just the war cabinet. And so there was something like 25 people at this meeting. And Boris Johnson in the Churchill Factor, he talks about this speech as being the most impactful speech of his entire career. Sadly, we don't have a recording of this. It wasn't given in the House of Commons, and Churchill evidently didn't read it 9 years later. But it is a speech that we know a fair bit about because of those who were there, particularly the diary of a man named Hugh Dalton. Wrote down a lot of the content. It's the choking in our own blood speech, where Churchill said, I have thought carefully in these last days whether it was part of my duty to consider entering into negotiations with that man. 3 days of contentious meetings, Guys like Halifax that wanted Churchill to negotiate. And Churchill admitted, okay, I thought about it. But it is idle to think that if we tried to make peace now, we should get better terms than if we fought it out. The Germans would demand our fleet. That would be called disarmament. Our naval bases, and much else. We should become a slave state through a British government, which would be Hitler's puppet. That's the reality. That's what they were facing. Those who wanted to surrender, they were fine with becoming a Nazi puppet state. Churchill said, and I'm convinced, this is what he told his cabinet, 25 men or so, I'm convinced that every one of you would rise up and tear me down from my place if I were for one moment to contemplate parley or surrender. While you would rip me to pieces if I even for one moment contemplated any kind of surrender. And then there's this famous line, one of his best. He says, If this Long Island story of ours is to end at last, let it end only when each one of us lies choking in his own blood upon the ground. And with that, there was no more discussion about Italy's willingness to mediate some sort of, or negotiate some sort of settlement. Halifax dropped it. Boris Johnson says in a Telegraph article, this was an article in 2014 that excerpted his book, The Churchill Factor. And Johnson says, the day Churchill saved Britain from the Nazis, and he points to this day, May 28th, 1940, the day that he gave that speech, the choking in our own blood speech in front of just 25 people, members of his cabinet, his government. Johnson says Churchill had ruthlessly dramatized and personalized the debate. By the time the war cabinet resumed at 7 p.m., the debate was over. Halifax abandoned his cause. Churchill had the clear and noisy backing of his cabinet. They came up, and Churchill writes about this in the Second World War. They came up, a number of these cabinet members. They were cheering, they were clapping, they were patting him on the back. And Halifax abandoned his cause. Then Johnson writes about the courage that it took to fight. He said, within a year of that decision, to fight on, that is, to fight and not negotiate, 30,000 British men, women, and children had been killed, almost all of them at German hands. Weighing up those alternatives, a humiliating peace or a slaughter of the innocents, it is hard to imagine any modern British politician having the guts to take Churchill's line. See, even in his day, Halifax didn't have the guts to do this. Neither did Chamberlain. But Churchill had the guts to make that call. We're going to fight. And a year later, 30,000 British men, women, and children had been killed. As Johnson brings out, Churchill had the vast and almost reckless moral courage to see that fighting on would be appalling, but that surrender would be even worse. That's pretty inspiring to think about what happened there. And those, he gave this speech on May 28th, 1940. He hadn't even been in office for 3 weeks. This is what he's coming into. This is how he's rallying the troops. That's the May 28th speech. And then one of the real head scratchers in this movie, another one of Churchill's most famous speeches, the "We'll Fight on the Beaches" speech. The movie makes it seem like he went in. I was really anxiously anticipating this May 28th address, the choking in our own blood address. And there was a polite applause, I guess, after the speech with his cabinet. I figured it would be a lot more boisterous. But anyway, he leaves this cabinet speech, and then he goes out into the hallway and he tells some of his aides that, well, I've got to hurry on and give another speech in the House of Commons, and I haven't even prepared it yet. So he had to hurry over to the House of Commons, and then that's where he gave this rousing speech that finally got all of Britain on his side. This is, again, to tell it the way the movie tells it. In fact, he gave that speech a full week, 7 days later. The fight on the beaches speech, he gave that on June 4th. And why the movie squeezes it all together, I don't know. And why the movie makes it seem like he didn't have that speech totally prepared and then gave this magnificent address, I suspect it was probably one of his better prepared speeches. It was really well received. The other thing that it misses, the context that you don't get by cramming it together with that May 28th address, is that May 28th, that's right around the time when the troops in Dunkirk were being evacuated. I think that started on May 26th, and it continued until the early days of June. And then Churchill followed up that evacuation, that miraculous evacuation, by addressing the House of Commons, June 4th, 1940. And he gets up and he says, look, 340,000 men have been saved from the jaws of death. 340,000. Now, as he went on to say, wars are not won by evacuations, but this was a victory nonetheless. This was some kind of deliverance. But he said, now look, Belgium has surrendered. France is in trouble. The French army is weakened. Hitler is going to turn his sights on Great Britain. It's coming. We're told that he has a plan to invade the British Isles. We've got to get ready for it. He said in that speech, June 4th, 1940, that when Napoleon gave thought to invade Britain, his aides told him that there are bitter weeds in England. In other words, it's not going to be easy. And Churchill, in that 1940 speech regarding the bitter weeds, he said, the bitter weeds analogy, he said, there are certainly a great many more of those bitter weeds since the British expeditionary forces have returned. In other words, we're ready to fight. And if Hitler wants to come after us, then he can expect some bitter weeds. He went on in this speech from June 4th, again, rather than play the reading that Churchill gave of this 9 years later, I'll refer you to the best moments of this movie, Darkest Hour, this speech at the end of the movie in particular. Here's Gary Oldman playing Churchill in the We'll Fight on the Beaches speech, clip 4.
I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and the best arrangements are made as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary, for years. If necessary, alone.
No hint of wavering. We're going to ride this out. We're going to fight, even if we have to fight alone. And Churchill, he was having lots of meetings at this time. He was also shuttling back and forth to Paris a lot, meeting with the French leaders. And he kept telling them, look, you've got to fight. You've got to stand firm. And even if you don't, even if you collapse, we will fight alone. And that's what happened. Here again is another excerpt from that June 4th, 1940 speech as portrayed in the movie, clip 5.
Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of the Nazi rule. We shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender!
It was a goosebump moment in viewing that film for the first time yesterday afternoon. It's just a shame that the story and the lead up to that speech, that concluding speech, it's a shame that the facts weren't presented. The truth of history. As if the story itself, the factual story itself, isn't inspiring enough. I mean, listen to that speech. If you hear renditions of that speech today in movies or lectures, oftentimes they conclude it right there with never surrender. But that's not how the speech ended. He went on to make some important comments, which, to the credit of the movie, The Darkest Hour, it did include the full statement. What he said after never surrender. But he went on to talk about, and well, let's suppose we are defeated, then what? Here's one last clip from that movie, the same scene, clip 6.
And if which I do not for a moment believe, this island or large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire, beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
That last bit there, following his comment that we shall never surrender, that was something that President Roosevelt in the United States wanted him to include, because Roosevelt had told him privately that, look, if you do end up subjugated and starving, you need to make sure that Hitler doesn't end up with your navy, your powerful navy, because then, as a last resort, we're going to intervene. The United States will have to intervene. And so he says there, if we end up starving to death, then our empire beyond the seas, I mean, our navy, Australia, Canada, wherever, I mean, they'll take over our navy, our British fleet, and they'll carry on the struggle. And then, in God's good time, the new world, speaking of America in particular, will step forward to rescue and liberate the old. The News Chronicle called that particular speech, that address by Churchill, a speech of matchless oratory, uncompromising candor, and indomitable courage. Harold Nicholson, who heard the speech, he wrote to his wife after the fact, saying, "This afternoon, Winston made the finest speech that I have ever heard." Another MP called it the speech of 1,000 years. Edward R. Murrow, the famous American broadcaster, he said that Churchill spoke the language of Shakespeare with a direct urgency which I have never before heard in that house. And so, as I say, you're left scratching your head at why the producers of that film would try to squeeze that together with the other famous speech from May 28th. And then portray Churchill coming out of that speech saying, I've got to hurry over to the House of Commons. I haven't even prepared my speech yet. Those are some amazing speeches. Matchless oratory. As I say, this is the best part. Clearly, this is the best part of The Darkest Hour. That speech at the end of the movie. And yet here the movie makes that speech. It makes that speech as sort of, well, Halifax and Chamberlain are not going to be able to bring down Churchill's government. That's sort of the lesson that you're left with. When in fact, this was the speech of the millennium, to paraphrase what one MP said. This was the speech that rallied a nation. This was a speech with the language of Shakespeare and with a direct urgency that people had never heard come out from that house. This was the rallying cry ahead of some dark times for the people of Britain. Yes, we were able to pull our guys out of Dunkirk, but you don't win wars by evacuating. And we've been told Hitler is on his way. He's coming after Britain next. These were dark times. I mean, this is history. This is history that our people need. They need to hear it today. Because we too are entering into dark times. And sadly, the historians and the commentators, the educators, the university professors, just like the one that got up at Oxford the other day or in the month of May, to argue that we should be embarrassed by Churchill, that we should be ashamed of Churchill. And that's what so many of our young people are being fed. Most of them aren't even looking into the truth. They're not going to read the Second World War by Churchill, and most biographers won't look to that either. Manchester did. Good for him. Manchester went to the source. Manchester didn't come along and just dismiss what Churchill wrote. Churchill's the one that lived through it. I mean, he was the central player. Oh, but he was biased. He was writing to pad his resume. Or to make himself look good. And so the modern biographer just immediately brushes that aside because, well, we can't have Churchill's view. We've got to take a much more critical and skeptical view, just like the movie makers do. A British filmmaker with the lead actor from Britain. And this is the best. This is the best. I mean, the other movie, Churchill, that was just dreadful. I think it was Andrew Roberts who said he sat down for a viewing of that and just off the top of his head counted something like 140 historical inaccuracies. That was the bad one. The good one, Churchill's indecisive. Churchill's wavering. Churchill needs inspiration from the subway people, the people riding on the subway, before he finally then delivers two of the greatest speeches of his life. And they're crammed together in one day for some odd reason. What does it say about going back to what Victor Davis Hanson said? You look at all of the ridiculous, the insulting comparisons. It's an insult on our intelligence to make these kinds of comparisons. Oh, yeah, there's Nazis at the border agents. They're Nazis. The president of the United States, he's Hitler. The people who voted for him, they're the brown shirts. My father over and again on the Key of David in several of his booklets, the trumpet.com website. He's talked about the lesson of history, or as he's put it, the law of history. He gave a program last year, just a few months ago, September of 2017, about how Churchill was educated. Listen to what he said here. This is clip 7.
Churchill's reading of history reinforced his early education to exalt heroic virtues. In other words, he really goes on to say that the foundation of Churchill's education was history. And here is a man that was said to have saved Western civilization. Don't we need to know about that history? Don't we need to understand that and why and how he saved Western civilization and how it was almost destroyed because people wouldn't listen to him? This is history at its very best, and we need to understand and learn from history.
What if a movie came along and took that angle, that Churchill's education was grounded in history, and that our civilization was very nearly destroyed because people wouldn't listen to Winston Churchill, because Neville Chamberlain didn't listen to Winston Churchill, or Halifax, or Baldwin before Chamberlain, all through the 30s, as Germany's violating the terms of Versailles, building up its army, its air force, its navy, and declaring to the world that we want to build an empire, that we want to exterminate Jews. All of that happened in the 1930s, even as Britain disarmed. Even as Britain downsized its military. What if a movie maker, you think about an opportunity. I mean, you see glimpses of it in the speeches that were in that movie, in that film. And what a modern movie maker is capable of doing with a fairly big budget and some quality actors. But what is all of that without the right script, without the facts on which to build the story? The foundation of his education was history. And Western civilization was very nearly destroyed because people ignored him. Just as Hitler, or rather Churchill said. I played that for you, or read it, just the other day. My father in that program, by the way, he's quoting from the Commager book about Churchill and his education and just lessons that we can draw from this. Here's another excerpt from The Key of David, clip 8.
Mr. Commager also said this: he cherished as a law of history the principle that a people who flout those virtues are doomed to decay and dissolution, and that a people who respect them will prosper and survive. He says, look, if you flout those virtues that we learn from history, that it's, you're doomed to decay and dissolution. That's what Winston Churchill said, the man whose foundational education was history. And for good reason, if you understand.
That's my father from his Key of David program in September of 2017, the fatal danger in not teaching history. He concluded, or at least I'll conclude, with one more clip here. This is from that same program. He's going through the lessons that we can take away from this history and from Winston Churchill. Here's clip number 9.
But let's look at the 7th lesson. The history of war is a part of history. Teaches a 7th lesson. Taught it not only to Churchill, but through him, the vital importance of leadership. He was a leader and a powerful leader. And he saved Western civilization, many historians will say, or quite a number of them anyhow. And he had, as another historian said, a historical perspective. He didn't just get wrapped up in the present. He saw the big picture, the past, the present, and the future. And he said, the farther you see in the past, the more deeply you can see into the future. It gives you vision to even prophesy, as he was credited with being able to do because of his learning history and being an expert in that history.
A powerful leader. There's a lot that you could tell on the big screen about someone such as that. But that's not the trend today, where, well, we've got to show how human he is, how vulnerable he was, how many flaws he had, how insensitive he was, how he was given to wine. He was indecisive. They forget about the positive view of history. My father writes on this. You see it even in the Bible. I mean, we do see the flaws of individuals too, but there are certain sections of the scriptures which really do focus in on the positive view of history because of God wanting us to really draw on the lessons of this kind of powerful, powerful leadership. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and that is about all that we have time for on today's program, even though I have a little bit more. I'll have to come to that tomorrow. Thank you for joining us today on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll see you tomorrow.